Almighty God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, God, we ask for your kindness today. We ask for your wisdom. Give us a heart to understand, and ears to open, eyes to open, and we see and follow your path and not our own. We praise you, God, for your wisdom. We thank you for this Shabbat and ask for your blessing. In your name, Yeshua HaMashiach. Amen. If you don't mind, I don't know if I have a reader here or not. Oh, I do. Will you please reread 2 Samuel chapter 9? It's not a terribly long chapter. We read it once last time, but just to refresh our memories.
David asked, "Is there still anyone left in the house of Saul to whom I may show kindness for Jonathan's sake?" Now there was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba, and he was summoned to David. The king said to him, "Are you Ziba?" And he said, "At your service." The king said, "Is there anyone remaining of the house of Saul to whom I may show the kindness of God?" Ziba said to the king, "There remains a son of Jonathan. He is crippled in his feet." The king said to him, "Where is he?" Ziba said to the king, "He's in the house of Machir, the son of Amiel at Lodebar." Then King David sent and brought him to the house, bought from the house of Machir, the son of Amiel at Lodebar. Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, son of Saul, came to David and fell on his face and did obeisance. David said, "Mephibosheth." He answered, "I am your servant." David said to him, "Do not be afraid, for I will show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan. I will restore to you all the land of your grandfather Saul, and you yourself shall eat at my table always." He did obeisance and said, "What is your servant that I should look upon a dead dog such as I?" Then the king summoned Saul's servant Ziba and said to him, "All that belonged to Saul and to all his house, I have given to your servant's grandson, to your master's grandson. You and your sons and your servants shall till the land for him and shall bring in the produce, so that your master's grandson may have food to eat. With your master's grandson, Mephibosheth shall always eat at my table." Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Then Ziba said to the king, "According to all that my lord the king commands his servant, so your servant will do." Mephibosheth ate at David's table like one of the king's sons. Mephibosheth ate a young son whose name was Micah, and all who lived in Ziba's house became Mephibosheth's servants. Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem, for he always ate at the king's table. Now he was lame in both his feet.
Thank you. That was a reread of 2 Samuel chapter 9. Those of you who recall, I introduced you to the chiastic structure. As Jeff correctly pointed out, it is a Greek word, so it's pronounced chi, not a Hebrew word. I'm used to the chi pronunciation, so I apologize. For any of you who are concerned by my mispronunciation. Okay. What did I tell you? What do you recall about the chiastic structure? Do you remember anything about it? Anything at all I covered 2 weeks ago? What it's about? Chiastic, spelled C-H-I-A-S-T-I-C. Pronounced chiastic. Yes, Ellie.
When it says the same words over and over in different places, there's a pattern to it. The repeats are not just repeats. He's saying something.
Right. Now, we've talked in amongst our group and probably in your own walks with God in other fellowships, other groups, that, well, the idea that, well, when God repeats himself is trying to emphasize it. Oh, repeat it for emphasis. That's what it means. Or repeat to accentuate the purpose behind what is being repeated. For example, it repeats the fact that Deuteronomy, for example, a lot of the laws written there are duplicates in other books. Well, it's to repeat for emphasis purposes, right? Well, not necessarily. Yeah, the Torah does do that, but God's not limited to that only fashion of disclosure of information. He uses what the Greeks call the chiastic structure, or chiasmus is the noun version of it. Last week, I showed you this example. The common version of a chiastic structure, when the Bible starts a pattern, starts saying a subject matter, and then continues on with the story, and then there's some kind of a turning point or a scenario that happens. Oh, sorry, you can move that. A scenario that happens, and then the story starts reversing itself later as the story progresses and continues on. This is very, very common throughout your Bible, as I mentioned it before. And the purpose as to why the story does that is to draw your attention to the turning point, the moment which the structure says, okay, I'm going to stop and now reverse. The goal is for you to observe the turning point, that moment in time when it says, I have to change direction. This is the way which, remember this. This means something to you. Now, these structures are usually built around a prophecy. There's something that's trying to disclose to you that the text itself is giving you information you may not have actually seen had you not paid very close attention. So this guy's structure is very common. The other one which I introduced to you last week, or 2 weeks ago, was this one, which is you have two duplicate stories, or very seemingly duplicate stories, and that the patterns or the sequence which events happen to one character are repeated very similarly later on in the Bible. For example, you have, as I gave the examples last time, the two spies from Joshua. A lot of their stories and how they were interacting with Rahab are very, very similar to Samson's interaction with his harlot. They have duplicates. They have similarities to them. Well, you also have in the story of Samson, which is the example I had shown you, which was the obvious one. This was the example I showed you, I wrote up here on the board here 2 weeks ago. But as you know, I have it highlighted, so bear with me. The chiastic structure shows... Oh, there's a little stick. I'm missing my stick. Use a pen. Chiastic structure says this example, which says, and the angel of the Lord appeared to the woman, is very, very similar to this, which is repeated 2 or 3 verses later. A man of God came unto me, and his countenance was like the countenance of an angel of God. They're similar subjects. They're similar type of description of what's being said. It's the angel of God. This is, by the way, this is when the event actually happened, and this is the woman's recounting of that event. And the next item is, but thou shalt bear a son. And of course, she's reverting, she also says, behold, I shall conceive and bear a son. She's relaying the story. Drink not wine or strong drink, nor eat anything unclean. Well, of course, she recounts in order, now drink no wine or strong drink or anything unclean. The child to be a Nazirite to God from the womb. So the child to be a Nazirite to God from the womb. Duplicate, except this moment in time the structure changes. He shall begin to deliver Israel out of the hands of the Philistines. That's what the angel told her. But when she regurgitated, reiterated the information, she says, she omits this and replaces it to the phrase, to the day of his death. She's giving you extra information that the angel didn't disclose to her. The object, the purpose is the why, is supposed to note that, oh, there's a pattern here. And the goal, what's the difference in the pattern, right? The difference is, he shall begin to deliver Israel out to the day of his death. Meaning, throughout this person, which is referring to Samson, of course, what God is telling us is that his death will deliver Israel out of under the hand of the Philistines. And that's exactly what happened. It was a symbol saying, hey, this is how it's going to hurt. It's a prophecy given. So the chiastic structure gives you this example. It's a very simple example. That's why I showed up 2 weeks ago. Well, as I also mentioned, there's some things in chapters that we already covered back in Joshua and back in Judges when I was going through early on the prophets a few years ago that I read past and I presented and I kept going, well, I didn't know what a chiastic structure was that time. So I just skimmed right past it and didn't care. Well, I intend to go back and cover at least 2 of those examples because I have to use them again in 2 Samuel, I think it's 17, but I have to use at least one of them again. 17, another one, I think it's chapter 13. So we should go back and discuss it. So far, everybody follows what happens, right? What's going on? Now, this is a very, very common scattered throughout your entire Bible. You will be hard-pressed to find more than maybe two chapters in a row in your entire Tanakh that does not have a Kaisic structure somewhere. You'll be hard-pressed to find it. I mean, the entire book of Esther, that's a massive Kaisic structure. You have half of the book of Genesis, Kaisic structures scattered all over the place. This one chapter 9 has five Kaisic structures built into a single chapter. If you try to map it out, it would be a funny little spider web, trying to see all these various sub-structures built into a single chapter. God is a very elaborate individual. When he's describing something or trying to disclose information to you, it's supposed to tingle your mind and let you say, okay, what does this mean? What's the purpose behind this? I've heard this before. It's designed to catch your attention and make you read deeper into the text. There's a reason the Bible is called a living book. It's not a dead book. Why? Because there's more information after you read it again and again and again. You gather more out of it. Well, these structures help facilitate that. Now, as I mentioned last time, is it easy for someone to write a structure like this? Very easy to write it. Poets do all the time. They're called poetry. Is it easy to live a life through a structure like this? Near impossible. If somebody recounted to you your entire life from beginning to till today, would you see very many Kaistic structures in it? Probably a few. The times which you'll notice, oh, I had to learn that lesson twice. You know, I did a mistake here, and this is what happened. Look, I did it again so many years later. But those lessons are lessons that God teaches us, isn't it? It's repetition, and we learn more from it from the first time, the second time. Yeah, the lesson was the same, but I learned a little bit more this time than I did the first time. That's how God teaches all of us. There's no difference between how he writes to us versus how he talks to us. Very similar. Well, there's more than just this. So I have to go beyond that. I want to just refresh your memory a little bit. So, Samuel chapter 9, which I covered two weeks ago, I was so focused and so thrilled about showing you what a Kaistic structure was, I didn't spend any real time telling you what in the world God's actually saying. Because, I mean, this is really cool, but so what's the message? Now, I kind of hinted to it, but I didn't spend enough time on it. I was like, you know what? And I realized when I got home that night, I had to stop, slow down, go back. Now that I know how God's saying it, what is he saying? Well, as I mentioned before in the examples I've given, this simple Kaisic structure gave the turning point being David the king. It means draw your attention to that turning point. But note the differences. The difference in this first portion of Samuel chapter 9, this is verse 1 through verse 3. The difference between the top and the bottom, meaning the very first event, it's very similar. It says, and he left the house of Saul and may show kindness to him for Jonathan's sake, and he left the house of Saul that showed kindness to of God unto him. See, a house of Saul, he's asking for somebody, but there's a difference. He's saying for Jonathan's sake versus for God's. And it's regarding David the king, what he's doing. Now, what's this portion of the structure telling us? Well, as I mentioned last time, David had a unique relationship with Jonathan. We all understand that? He loved him. They loved one another. They had unique bonds, they had unique covenants, which they struck with one another over and over again, regarding descendants, regarding how they would treat one another. There were deals being made. Well, as you also note, that because the love between David and Jonathan is repeated so many times in 1 Samuel, it's over and over and over again, you kind of get the feeling of the idea, it's important. This love actually means something. Well, you also have heard the phrase, David is a man after God's own heart, right? Well, what do we think of when you think of heart? Well, most people think of love. Did God love David? Does David love God? Does Jonathan love David? Does David love Jonathan? This Kaistic structure, the objective, which is fulfilled in the second half of the book, of this chapter, is to tell you, the love between David and Jonathan that causes David to want to show kindness to Jonathan is the same love between God and David that causes David to show the love of God through Jonathan's son. The love's important because God's telling us something very specific about the Messiah in this book, in this particular chapter. What does that love of David result in between Jonathan and David? What's the fulfillment in the rest of the chapter? What does he actually do?
Teaching us to have a deep love for one another.
That's true, it does. There's a little more specific as far as what it is. It does teach us to have love for each other, but that's in very detail what David actually ends up doing.
Isn't it the fulfillment of a covenant that he made with Jonathan earlier in life? Where they were blessing each other's descendants, right?
It is. And the entire book, you could read it strictly as a fulfillment of that covenant. But there's more to it than just the book. Because the way this chapter was written, it means something. It's organized in a particular fashion to give more than just that fulfillment. But yes, that fulfillment is a key core point. This is the remaining half of the chapter, as we mentioned last time, we brought it up before. This guy's, he's lame in his feet, the very top of the structure, and the bottom, it repeats, lame in his feet. He's the king. Where does Mephibosheth live? In Lodabar. Where does he live here? In Jerusalem. Where is he at? In the house of Achir. Where is he here? In the house of Ziba. Where is he here? Now, Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, and look, Mephibosheth had a young son. It's referred to the top of the son versus son. You have, thou shalt eat bread at my table continually. Thou shalt eat bread as one of the king's sons. Thy servant. The king called to Ziba. Ziba called to the king. Therefore, thou sons and thy servants shall serve him. Ziba had 15 sons and servants. Thy master's son may have bread to eat at my table. Thy master's son shall eat bread always at my table. And with the ship is the turning point. This structure here has a turning point of Mephibosheth. As I mentioned last time, Mephibosheth's a very important character in this particular chapter. So we have four unique things that occur in this chapter. We have the love between Jonathan and David is discussed, the love between God and David, David being the king, and Mephibosheth being a benefactor. In the entire chapter, Mephibosheth is the benefactor of this love that David has. So now we've recapped a little bit of what we just discussed last time. What's the message? What is it about this love, about David and Mephibosheth, that God's trying to tell us? Yes, Carrie.
I don't know if this is it, but if my memory serves me correctly, Saul was from the tribe of Benjamin.
Correct.
And David is from Judah.
Judah, correct.
I just see a picture of a name, Saul, his kingship. A name that has gone bad.
Gone bad?
God removed himself.
Removed Saul's glory of
right.
King.
Right. And then all of his sons were killed the same day he was. But the Messiah gets to redeem him, where Mephibosheth seems to, it's almost like he's like the lost tribes. Just from a picture that I can see here, because it's a name that they don't have their name anymore. They're lost, and they're coming back, and they're redeemed. They get to eat at the table.
You have a good point there. Now, that's actually an element of what's happening here. Not the full thing, but you have an element of it. Yes, Rose.
Well, this is my understanding.
Go right ahead. I'll explain this in a minute.
David is a type of Christ.
Correct.
Mephibosheth is us. Mm-hmm. A Lodabar is,
no
well,
word.
Mephibosheth,
no.
Let me say a little bit more about him. Being crippled, we before Christ dealt with us, was crippled in sin. Lodabar represents the world. And we were crippled living down in Lodabar in the world. Mm-hmm. And David, being a type of Christ, sent for us. He does the calling. And so he sent for us and called us. We were eating in Lodabar garbage and dirt and filth. He brought us up out of the world and set us at his table that we could sit and eat with him.
What she has expressed, we all have our own takes of the elements, the shadows that God's given us in this story. So what she's expressed is a very good thing to express. Mind you, my objective up here today, and each of them covered these chiastic structures, which I will do periodically. Hold on a minute. I have no intention of regurgitating garbage to you or just throwing the answer out to you. The goal is for you to observe the elements and try to make the connections yourself. I will explain to you what I see, but that doesn't mean I'm necessarily right. I'll explain to you why I see it the way I do. But you will each gather something slightly different. There's a reason why it's a living book, as I mentioned before. You will get more and more out of it the more and more times you read. Yes.
I see it as the David as a type of the Father.
Mm-hmm.
Jonathan as a type of Yeshua. And Mephibosheth as the type of humanity. You know, Lord has saved, you know, the crippled.
You both have covered very, very close to what I happen to perceive. I'm going to describe this a little bit differently, and I'll explain to you why I'm going to describe it this way. So bear with me. Note, Hector's comment that says David is a type of God, the Father, is given to you in a hint that says David the King. Who is the ultimate king? It's not Messiah. It's his father. That's the ultimate king. The next portion of what Hector picked up on, and Rose did as well, is the love between David and Jonathan makes David do what? He says to Jonathan's son, "You are my son." He adopted him. David's telling Jonathan, "I love you because I love you. Your son is my son. He will eat at my table as one of my sons continually," which means forever. The hint that I perceive from it, and the reason I perceive it, I'll tell you this in a minute, is that the love that David had with Jonathan that results in this transaction to occur is God has the same love with David. So, bear with me. David says to Jonathan, essentially in this book, "I love you. Your son will be mine." God is saying to David, "I love you. Your son will be mine." God and David are one and the same in the story. It's the love that you're going to we're focusing on. What does the love cause? Well, as we all know, did God choose a son of David? Well, you better believe it. He became God's son. He not only became God's son, he got to eat at God's own table. He is his son. But he's David's son as well. Well, Mephibosheth, same result. It's the love we're focusing on. Now, why do I think this? If you recall, some of you recall, a number of months ago, I discussed when the Bible talks about something and it's in a prophetic fashion, and you have something that's life, death, and number three. Tony Robinson mentioned this many years ago, and he did a fantastic job analyzing this, so I gotta give full credit for this. When the Bible discusses something regarding life and death, and the number three, it is a prophecy or a shadow of the Messiah in some fashion. Now, we had discussed this back when David ran across the Egyptian, the one who was abandoned for 3 days and three nights, should have died with no food and no water, and yet he lived. We also have the process when David had to leave the battlefield to come home. It took him three days travel to get there. What did he find when he got home? Desolation, complete destruction. But no one died. See, it's a life and death scenario. Three is involved. But somebody who should have died, when a town is taken over, militarily, typically at least more than zero die. Typically. Now, granted, there may be exceptions, but typically, if you have a massive army, they walk with swords, they plow through your town to kill everybody, and they kill no one. That's unusual. That should draw your attention. So when David and his men came to their home and found their whole city completely razed, destroyed, and destroyed utterly, everything gone, but they point out not a single soul died. No one died. And he goes up 3 days, 3 nights later, runs across this Egyptian who should be dead. After 3 days and three nights with no food and water, exposed to the elements, you will die. Typically. But the Egyptian lives. So, two examples of something who should be dead, yet conquers death, lives. This is no different. If you have a story and a number three shows up, and it's regarding life or death, there should be something regarding the Messiah in it. Now, if you look very closely at chapter 9, you will find there is no number three in it. Unless you look a little bit closer. Look at the phrases. How many times is "he will eat at my table" repeated? In the book, the entire chapter, chapter 9, the phrase "he will eat at my table" is repeated 3 times. It's repeated in verse 7, 11, and 13. When is the place where Mephibosheth lives? It's repeated exactly 3 times. Verses 4, 5, and 13. Where is kindness, or that David or God may show kindness unto him? Repeated exactly 3 times. Verses 1, 3, and 7. So does number 3 show up in chapter 9? It does. 3 times. So you have a story, a chapter, that discusses a prophecy of someone becoming God's son, who would not normally have been so. Because normally, if Mary had a child, would that be immediately default to being God's son? Well, of course not. It would be Mary's son and the descendants thereon. But God is saying, someone who is not my son, which normally would not be the son, no, Messiah would normally, there would be an immaculate conception typically. Those of us who have lived our lives would know that. Doesn't normally happen. God's going, I'm taking this one, or I'm making this one my son. Same that David's doing. So that process of taking someone who is not my son to be my son because my love repeats 3 times. And what does it do? It's from God's kindness. What results to the son? He eats at God's table as one of God's sons. Where does he live? From no word or no law, Lodabar, to Jerusalem, city of peace, God's hometown. This person, this is an adoption process. This is an example given to the Tanakh, that's giving you a shadow of who the Messiah is going to be. No, these guys don't have the Book of Psalms. These guys don't have Isaiah. They don't have Jeremiah or any of the minor prophets. They've got nothing. They have from Genesis up until this point. We have all this wonderful advantage. We have the minor prophets, and they have all this extra stuff to give. That's great and all. But how did they know what was happening? Where did the prophets get their information from? How many times did God visit one of the prophets? Well, how many times did God visit one of you? When it happens, guess what? They wrote it down. It's called in your book, in your Bibles. What about the rest of their lives? Well, God didn't visit you 24/7, nonstop, from the day your birth to the day you die. He didn't talk to you as a conversation forever and ever and ever. It was occasionally, give you information. What did they do between the time which God spoke to me this month, and then he spoke to me 4 years later here? What happened between those 4 years? They read. They studied. They paid attention to God's word. They looked around them and taught people. Well, what were they teaching? What the Torah and the what we call the early prophets already said, already wrote down. Yes, Ellie.
Not only are each of those spoken 3 times, there are 3 of them.
Yes, there are 3 of them. So it gives you a hint. Now, the most commonly repeated word in this entire chapter, son. It's 11 times. Son. Give you a hint, son. The next one, servant. It also gives you hints of what the topic is about, what God's trying to say. There's a servant here. There's a son here. I'm adopting someone as my son. Note, the Tanakh does not give you a picture of Messiah. If that was the case, it would say, this person's name is Messiah. Look what he does. He will die. And he will do this and he will do that. Granted, there are a few of them that are like that. You get little hints here and there throughout the Psalms. But the Tanakh doesn't do that. It doesn't give you a picture, a photograph. It gives you a shadow. An image that, okay, there's something about this. I don't understand it yet fully, but there's something about this I will find out later. And of course, as the books and as the lives and the text continues on throughout the Torah, Tanakh, you get a better shadow. And all these shadows start adding up. And then when the Messiah actually shows up on the scene, say, I recognize you. I see you. I know who you are. Look what you're doing. Now I know. Why was David, man after God's own heart? He saw stuff that even Moses didn't see. That's impressive. He understood something about God that even Moses didn't get a chance to understand. The prophets did the same. They got to see shadows that Moses didn't get to see. Moses got to see his own shadows. He portrayed them. He showed them the best he could in writing it in the Torah. But God doesn't just say, okay, when Deuteronomy is finished, okay, you know, period point there, stop. I will no longer disclose any more information about my son. Or I will change my technique. Well, God doesn't do that. He's the same as he always was. He talks to each one of us by regurgitating our own lives to us. Learn the lesson again. Learn the lesson again. Learn it again. Well, he writes to us the exact same way. Learn the lesson again. Read it again. Learn more. This is the conclusion of chapter 9. Any questions so far? Because there's two more I have to discuss today. Also, going to take forever. Anybody lost? Y'all make sense? Everybody understands what's going on, what I've said so far? Good, because there's a lot more to this. God's more complex than that. Granted, this looks like a math equation, and it sort of is, but bear with me. When you're making thematic ties in the Bible, meaning that I've got so-and-so over here who lives a certain type of life and there's certain events in his life, and then so many generations or years or books later, I have another completely different person, but living similar life or similar event is happening to him. The objective is from God is for you to say, okay, I have got two parallel stories that look an awful lot alike. Look at them both, cross or juxtapose, as you call it. Bring them up to one another, look at, and see what the differences are. What am I learning? What does one story tell me about the other one? If God gives me information, and by the way, Messiah said it, that he is the most prophesied individual in the entire Tanakh. So when you're looking for a prophecy, look for him in it. That's typically what you're going to find. But there's a use for it, a very important use, which gives us information how you can build a shadow image on top of more shadow images, get a better picture of what Messiah is. If I've got a structure that says, all right, event, this one event is equivalent to this other event over here. So, for example, where I've got Samson, an example which I showed you, it said, all right, he will be a Nazarite until his death. And also, the earlier it said, he will save Israel. Those two events where you look upon each other, oh, well, there's a difference here. They're giving you information. He will save Israel through his death. That's what it's telling you. Or begin to save Israel through his death. Well, it goes one way, but it also goes backwards. Which I'm going to cover this in a few minutes, if I have an individual later on, a couple hundred years later, that lives the same life or similar scenario in their life that Samson had, and they match each other, and this chiastic structure matches, God's telling you this person later on is the same person as Samson was. The same shadow is trying to be shown to you. And it adds to that. If that second person is then attached to a third individual, similarly, it means that third person is the same as Samson, the first person. Everybody follow so far? It's a basic math, which follows. Basically, it's transitive property, they call it. I think it's transitive property. A equals B, then B equals A. And if B equals C, then C also equals A. They're all equivalent to each other. They're really, really simple. I think it's transitive. My property? Oh, I forgot the name of it. Anyway, forgive me for those mathematicians out there. I've forgotten my own. I was almost a math major, too. Go figure. How did that happen? I don't know what the words are anymore. Okay. That makes sense so far, right? Nobody's lost on that basic math equation, right? I hope not. That's how God talks to us. This is a previous chiastic structure that happened in Joshua. It's Joshua chapter 2. Now, when I covered Joshua chapter 2 a few years back, I can't remember how long it's been, I skimmed past this because I didn't see it. Well, now that I've been taught how to look for these things through this same book, which I mentioned before, I'll mention it again. It's the Scroll of the Gospel of David written by Tony Robbins, and he instructs you how to see these. These are really not complicated once you get the idea of how they're written. This story of Joshua, the son of Nun, who sent two spies to Jericho, has remarkable similarities to this story, which when Samson went to Gaza and saw a harlot. Now we think of, wait a minute, what on earth does a harlot and Samson's inability to control his own personal desires have to do with two spies spying out Jericho for a military battle? That seems bizarre. Well, God talks to us in funny ways. No, this structure, I did this coloring highlight, so bear with me. I hope that you can all read it and see it. This Joshua, son of Nun, sent two of his spies to go view the land of Eben of Jericho. Well, it just so happens in Judges chapter 16, Samson went to Gaza and saw something there. Now, while saw and viewing land, is that the same? They do more than just that. The idea of seeing something is the objective. They both view something. What do they do next? They both go to a harlot's house. What do they do after that? They stay there. The spies lodge there. Sam stays there until midnight, which he goes and leaves. The spies escape while it's still dark. Note. Again, midnight, very similarities. While the spies are there, Joshua chapter 2, verse 2, it says, the king was told of Jericho, saying, behold, there came men here tonight. Well, while Samson was there, men told the Gazaites, saying, Samson is coming here in the middle of the night. Similarities, isn't there? And the king says, goes to Rahab, bring forth the men. He surrounds Rahab's house. Well, what happens to them? To the spies, sorry, to the Rahab, they surround Rahab's house. And they go to compass him, which you know why the spies had to go out the door, because the house was surrounded. They couldn't exit the house. And it says, in Samson's time, they encompassed him in and laid wait. They surrounded the harlot's home. They knew where he was. They knew where the spies were. They knew where Samson and the spies were. Same spot. The woman hid them. Samson arose at midnight unseen. He is hidden. Middle of the night, he's hidden. The high night hid him here versus she hiding them there. There's a reason why that's done. We'll discuss that in Samuel chapter 17. Why it's that she had to hide him versus the night hiding him. It says, the gate, when it was dark, by the way, she is telling the men a lie. Oh, they went out the gate when it was dark. And that's where they took off. Well, what does Samson do? What does it mean? Like, he goes to the gate, rips it off the city walls, and runs with it. These two have a similar structure to each other. They're in pattern with one another. They're in sequence. The objective, when you read Joshua chapter 2, it should draw your attention when you come across Judges chapter 16. Wait a minute. This sounds somewhat familiar. Now, we've discussed the past. Rahab the harlot. Oh, we don't like to use the word harlot, because maybe she wasn't a harlot. Maybe she was this, maybe she was that. The Bible uses the term harlot in order for you to see this structure. If she was the innkeeper, as your Bibles would have translated potentially the innkeeper versus a harlot, would you have noted the connection between the two spies and Samson? I wouldn't. I wouldn't have seen them. I wouldn't even consider them. But the fact that both saw a harlot gives you an indication. Now, why is this structure here? What's God trying to tell us in this one particular structure? That's fair. But there's more to it than just that. Yes, Carrie?
I doubt this is what you're pointing out, but it sounds eerily similar to Messiah hiding for a while in Egypt.
Yes, very similar. Note, Rahab is going to be tied to Passover in a few verses from this chiastic structure for a reason. She experiences the same thing that the Israelites experience, but we'll get to that in a minute. This structure, the objective is to tie these two individuals together. Because Samson, as we already know, and we had discussed just a few minutes ago, he is a type of Messiah. Through his death, Israel begins to be saved. That's a Messiah-type character. All right. So Samson, and that was before Judges 16, Samson's already established a Messiah-type character. Now, what else about Samson makes him a Messiah-type character? Well, if I'm attacked by a lion and I have no weapon, what usually happens? I die. So Samson should have died. But what happened to Samson? He lived. It's almost like he had a quote, power, in a quote, over death. He lived in a scenario that should have killed him. these men are tied together to Samson, and these men are going to be tied to another set of spies in chapter 17 who are also tied to Samson. Yes, Ellie.
Yes, that the difference is the fact that the guy pulls down the doors. And did the Messiah not pull down the doors?
Yes. There is a reason why it says Samson pulled down the doors and the men didn't. Oh, no, there are other similarities, too, between these men and Samson. Note, these men were hidden with socks of flax. Samson was completely disarmed, use the term, with ropes that turned into flax. You recall that? The Philistines thought they were safe. He would be disarmed. He's no longer around. He's unable to harm us. He's tied up. The ropes turned to flax. The men were saved in flax, with flax. But that's a minor point. There are other similarities, too. We'll get there in a minute. Where's this why we're talking about these two spies in this one? This is a structure that happens later on in the exact same chapter 2 of Joshua. This one begins in verse 16 and ends in verse 22. This is very important because this structure is going to show up and it means something to us. They've already been tied to Samson. We already know that these men, their lives are a type of or some kind of shadow of Messiah's life. All right? Because Samson is a shadow of Messiah's life. This just confirms that. So this Joshua chapter 2, verse 16, it says, "And she said to them, get you the mountain, lest the pursuers meet you, hide yourself 3 days." Note, number 3 showed up. "Until the pursuers be returned, and afterward you may go your way." The men said to her, "We will be blameless of thine oath, which thou hast made us swear. Behold, we come to the land, and thou shalt bind this line of scarlet thread in the window." We'll stop there for a minute. Note, it says, the verse 16 says, "And she said to them, get the mountains to the pursuers." And what does that verse 22 say? "And they went, came to the mountains, and abode there 3 days." It's a duplicate verse. The structure thus begins. The second verse, verse 17, "And the men said, we will be blameless for this oath that was made." What does this one say? Verse 22, "Thou shalt out of this business, then we will quit of thine oath which thou hast made us made." Note, this also substructure. "Bind this scarlet line of thread to your window." And verse 20, she said, "And she bound the scarlet line of thread to the window." It's a substructure within the main structure. Those are very common, by the way. Continues on in verse 19. "And it shall be, whoever still goes out the doors of thine house in the street, his blood shall be on his head." Also duplicated at the last half of that same verse. "And whoever should be with thee in the house, his blood should be on our head." They're both talking about who's responsible for someone's death and regarding who's in and outside of a house. And what's the turning point? We will be guiltless. So, we have a prophecy. We have a Kaisic structure. We have life and death being discussed. And number 3, all built into, 6 verses? 5 verses. Yeah, 5 verses. What's the message? What's the shadow that we're supposed to be seeing? Yes, Rose.
Daniel, I maintain this book could be called the hymn book.
The hymn book?
H-I-M.
Okay.
The hymn book.
Okay.
After 3 days being hidden, there is a declaration of not guilty.
Yes. That's the shadow. After 3 days of hidden, they'll be declared, you are not guilty. You are innocent.
Thanks, Jeff, for taking my comment.
That's what the shadow is. It's telling you that. Great minds think alike. That's the reason two are married. After 3 days, we will be guiltless. Well, does that not also mimic the Messiah? Yeah, it does. These men, this Kaistic structure that God's written for us to view and see and understand, is giving us a shadow of who the Messiah is going to be. Now that we've seen the Messiah, of course, written in the New Testament, we see, clearly, it's an obvious fit. It's a reiteration. These men are actually tied to Messiah. They're actually, their livelihood, the way in which they're obeying their lives, is trying to give a shadow to the Messiah. But there's more than just this. Right? These are the only two structures I want to cover today, but there's more to it than just that. This structure is pretty easy to follow.
These men are already tied to Samson, which we'll get to that, why they're tied to Samson, more later on. This is important. My little discussion here, granted not many of you can read this, but it's okay. When did this event occur? Well, of course, when they crossed the Jordan, entering the land. Yes, what time of year? Passover, second year. Or second, first year they enter the land, yeah. After 40 years in Moloah. It's Passover time. How do I know that? Well, Joshua, chapter 4, verse 19. It's chapter 4, verse 19. Maybe I got that right. Yes, 4, verse 19. Discusses it's 10 days before Passover once they cross the Jordan. Well, of course, you have then circumcision. You got a few days recovery there. You have the 7 days of circling the Jericho. Well, let's say 10 plus 3. Okay, that's 13. You got a few days overlap there, potentially. 7 days. Guess what? By the end of days of unleavened bread, Jericho's on the ground. Roughly. Maybe a day or two off. Hard to say, but it's on the ground. This is where the structure gets more interesting. Because this particular story, and how we know that these men are tied to Messiah, and Rahab the harlot is the connection between her and Samson. That's what makes the connection work between her and Samson. What actually happened in the story? Note, as the structure points out, the men said, tie this scarlet to the window during Passover time. What is it that you're supposed to do? Well, there's red blood on the doorposts, right? Well, what's this window and scarlet thread have to do with the doorposts and blood? Well, note, the men surrounded Rahab's house, so the window became a door to these two spies, didn't it? The window was converted into a door. These two spies could come and go in it. That door was marked with red around it. As protection, they said, anybody goes in or out of this house, is their blood's on their hand. What happened during Passover in Exodus? You went to the door with the red blood around you. Don't go out. If you go out, your blood's on your own hands. God is blameless in your death. Rahab, the harlot, lived through her own Passover. And she is our connection between her and Samson. She also happens to be the main connection between her and David's two spies in chapter 17. It's a woman who does a concealing, and men are dumped into a well. And we'll discuss what the term well means as far as the book of Genesis is concerned when we get to chapter 17. Which, well, is a grave. It's the same thing. Same word as a pit, as endless, bottomless pit, a well. It's all the same word. It's all the same Hebrew word. Any questions so far? I know it's a lot to absorb. Bear with me. It's not complex. It's just a lot to absorb. Anything else?
I just got a comment.
Yes, by all means.
I heard something the other day I thought was pretty neat. It says, the Old Testament is the New Testament concealed. The New Testament is the Old Testament revealed.
It very much is. That's essentially what you're doing. Granted, these are just a few of the points I want to bring up to you. And the reason I brought them up to you today is because, as you know, I'm covering 2 Samuel. While chapter 9, which is what we just covered today, was a simple Kaisic structure to introduce to you. While chapter 13, we're going to introduce to Satan. That's important. You got to know who he is. Yes, we know the story of Adam and Eve, and we know the story of Job, and we know the story of Messiah and Judas Iscariot. Well, there's more to it than just that. Satan doesn't bump his head up just those few times. Satan shows up more frequently than that. And the Bible gives you indicators when he pops his head up and when he doesn't. Messiah's interaction with Satan through David is more, I won't say the word elaborate, it's more emotional than what it originally would appear. We get this detached idea of Messiah and Satan are opposite spectrums, they hate each other, they're fine with that. Well, that's not actually true. Messiah and Satan are not on opposite sides hating each other. They're fine with that. They're not fine with that. They may be opposite sides hating each other, but it's not that they're fine. They're emotionally attached because the same creator created them. One just took the other one's job, and he doesn't like it. That's the principle behind the two. That's their dynamic. Well, David's dynamic and what happens to his family and him gives us a deeper understanding of that interaction, of how those two, if I can use the term relatives or brothers, you can call them that, not really, how they dislike one another and what it actually means emotionally to them. If you want to understand the heart of God, and David's after God's own heart, you have to understand the emotions behind him. Why he does what he does. It's not an arbitrary, flippant thing. So these individuals that we've tied together show up again. So we all, on the same page, have a general idea that chiastic structures are in the Bible, first of all. Hopefully you understand that and accept that part. You may not like whatever, you know, conclusions I drew, that's okay. But accept the fact that they even exist. That's a plus. We're all in the right direction to even accept the fact that God even talks to us in that fashion. That God talks to us through repetition, not just of words, but of actual events in our own personal lives, as well as the lives of those who we read about. Yes, Jeff.
I think one of the things that the chiastic structure emphasizes is that with the idea of shadows, shadows are not mere.
Right, they're not
mere. They're not mere or trivial.
Right.
And the precedent is just as important as the what comes after.
It is. Well put.
Because those who would try to say, oh, it's a shadow, thus unimportant, are missing the point,
the whole point
that they go together as a pair.
Well, and this actually bring that point very importantly, and granted, because my mind happens to be on this particular topic, it goes there, that if a false Messiah showed up, and he challenged your very foundation, meaning that, say, for example, he could demonstrate to you that Messiah didn't raise from the grave, convincingly so, how do you know he's not lying to you? How do you know he is lying to you? How do you know he's telling the truth? How do you not know he's telling the truth? How do you know? How does your foundation, how strong is it? It's just, well, Messiah said, well, yeah, it's great and all, but if he's saying, I'm Messiah, and I didn't say that, how do you combat him? The Tanakh battles for you through stuff like chiastic structures. There should be a death and a resurrection in 3 days. What does John say? Those who deny the death and resurrection, those who deny there's three things he forgot. He came in the flesh and there's three things you die. Anyone who denies those three things, they're a liar. Well, if he comes along and denies those three things, how do you know he's a liar? Well, just because John said so? There's more to it than that. These men of the New Testament stood upon the men who wrote the Tanakh. And that was their foundation. That was their rock. Is it our rock as well? It needs to be. There's a reason why David understood a lot about the Messiah that we don't understand now. There's a reason why he's called a prophet. He was just a man. He was just king. Did God talk to him a lot? Not technically, no. He talked to him through prophets, but not him directly very often. But he still wrote a lot of stuff down. And we're supposed to memorize that stuff. Because that is supposed to be our rock. That we know who the Messiah is. We can prove it. And not require Messiah's words to do it. That's my personal belief. That I can prove without a shadow of doubt in my own heart, I don't even need the New Testament to say, I know who the Messiah is. That's not easy to do. That's my goal. That's what I want to be. That I can stand on and say, my foundation is too strong to break. Chiastic structures help me do that. It gets me that step further, that much further. Those shadows, as Jeff pointed out, those aren't trivial. That's what builds, that's how we identify who the Messiah is, not just by his words, but all the events that he lived through and how they're prophesied. Yes, Jeff, last comment?
Yeah, I just was saying that that's part of what Paul would do when he would speak and till midnight and such like that. There's a lot to talk about, and there's a lot that you can double check, just as the congregation in Berea did.
Exactly. Have a wonderful remaining Shabbat. Thank you for your time. I probably will not be covering Kaisa structure next week or next time I'm here. I have to go to another issue, but in chapter 10, which will be a fun discussion. But this will come up again, so try not to forget them as best you can. God bless you all.